break for that brother in New York and left today, but they're running a little bit late. They should hear, should be here any moment. So we're going to start with our other speakers, but first I'd just like to say a few words. And mostly, thank you so much for coming here and taking your time to come to this panel, but more importantly, thank you for the leadership you've shown in imagining these programs and actually implementing them. So,
hello.
Are we okay? I'm also very honored to be up here on stage with you, and I'm sure the audience is really looking forward to this session. I also want to thank Chris Levenick from the Roundtable. I don't know if he's in here. He's a tall guy. He really helped put this session together and invite the speakers and help coordinate it. So thanks, Chris. The backgrounders for all four panelists, who are coming, are in your binders, and there's also a sample of page that has an update that has your background and talking about this country biographers. I'm sure you want to hear, by the way, as soon as possible, appreciate their story and how you started the programs and your mission and the impact you're having on veterans. So at the end of the session, we'll do a lot of time for Q&A, so there'll be plenty of time for audience. I'll go off for a few questions and then open it up to the audience after our panel program. And with that, the two missing fellows, Ken Fisher, the CEO of the Fisher House Foundation, Martin Edelman, who is trustee of the Intrepid Call of Heroes Fund, Steve Narditi, the executive director of the Wounded Warrior Project, which is headquartered here in Jacksonville, Florida, and finally, Mike Haney. He is the founder and executive director of the Entrepreneurship Boot Camp for Veterans and professor there as well. So with no further ado, Steve, if you could set us off.
All right. Well, since we flipped the format here a little bit and I'm going first, I thought rather than jump right into our programs, I would I'd tell you a little bit about the population that we're dealing with. And here we're going to have a lot of people have different visions in their mind on what that is. And so let me talk about the magnitude of the problems and the crises that we're seeing amongst returning veterans from Afghanistan and Iraq right now. The numbers can be counted, and they're growing. There's over 40,000 right now physically wounded warriors from these conflicts. And those physical wounds are relatively traumatic and varied in terms of the type of injuries that you're seeing. The most predominant are blast injuries caused by IEDs, improvised explosive devices, RPGs, rocket propelled grenades. Because of the wonderful advances in both healthcare and in body armor, a lot of these warriors are living through wounds that in past generations and in past conflicts they would have died from, but they're living with very severe disabilities. So we're seeing a lot of amputations, arms, legs, a lot of burn injuries, severe burns, usually to the face, usually to the arms, usually to the legs, and then a lot of secondary injuries, certainly a lot of gunshot wounds, much smaller numbers, thankfully, spinal cord injuries and paralysis, but even bigger than those numbers. So as daunting as those numbers can be, and the lifelong care that some of those warriors need, even more daunting are the invisible wounds of war. One of the largest populations we have right now are traumatic brain injuries. Those are injuries caused usually by a blast or concussive force. Oftentimes, it's warriors who had a physical injury as well as now an injury to their brain due to the concussive force that they received. But many times, they don't have a physical injury, and just the sheer concussive force being around a blast like that has a long-term impact on them. And with a traumatic brain injury, it can be mild memory loss, it can be mild loss in cognitive function to something as severe as somebody who either is in a coma for the rest of their life or has such severe cognitive function they can't move their arms, they can't move their legs, they need lifelong care from a family caregiver. So that's sort of the broad range of disabilities when you talk about socioeconomic challenges that our warriors face. Those are equally severe. The population, about two-thirds of the warriors we're seeing come back right now, have no college degree. They have some college or high school or a GED, probably were looking for a manual labor job, probably looking to stay in the military for the rest of their life, and now faced with a disability, faced with the loss of their uniform and their teammates, They're returning to communities, many of them left to get out of the socioeconomic situation they were in. Now they're being returned to those communities and have to rethink their life, rethink their job, maybe go back to school, maybe get training, and maybe they were never the best student to begin with. So that's sort of the magnitude of the challenge we as a country are facing when these warriors are returning. And I'll talk a little bit about what we're doing at the Wounded Warrior Project to help with that. So we got founded in 2003. It was about the start of these conflicts, and it was a group of us who had been working with other veterans groups in the past. I had been already working. I'm now in my 16th year working with veterans, and mainly veterans from Vietnam era, World War II, and the model of service for those warriors was get them some government benefits. I didn't want to emphasize that point quite that much. Get them some government benefits, get them their health care, and move on. And I think one of the challenges we face as a country is that there's great health care out there, and there are great government benefits, but those benefits do not meet all the needs of the warriors. And that's one of the things that I want to impress upon you guys today as we talk. So first thing that we did is we started with engagement. We actually work at the hospital bedside. We start with warriors while they're still active duty, before they become a veteran, and start dealing with their challenges there. If you've seen our logo, which is on my pin, it's one warrior carrying another, and that's been a foundation for all of our programs. We carry it through, and we found there is a healing to having one warrior return after going through recovery and help another warrior through their recovery. So we run thousands of events all over the country, keeping warriors engaged with each other both while they're in the hospital and when they get back home. We have the only certified peer mentoring program in the country across all types of disabilities, where we train warriors who have gone through their recovery to mentor another warrior and family member through theirs. And that engagement prevents isolation, it prevents depression, and it also energizes a warrior to not say, this is enough for me in my recovery, I need to have a more independent life. What we've seen is about 95% of the warriors who go through those types of programs have a better outcome at the end and report that they are more self-confident and they're willing to challenge themselves more to move on with their life and be more independent when they've had a mentor. It's a dual benefit for the person mentoring, because they get to give back. And really, you know, our mission is to honor and empower wounded warriors, and we think empowerment really comes when you get somebody to a point in their life where they not only feel good enough about themselves, but they feel like they have the opportunity to give back and help somebody else. We've basically looked at three big areas of programs that we work with: mental health, physical health, and what we call economic empowerment, education, and employment. And what we found is if we don't take that holistic approach as a country to warriors, then they slip through the cracks and one issue affects another. If you're physically not doing well and not as independent as you should be, that affects your mental health and also affects your ability to pursue an education, pursue your life goals, to get a job. If you don't have a job and you're sitting at home and you're living in your head, it tends to exacerbate some of the mental health issues we've seen: combat stress, post-traumatic stress disorder, depression, a horrible number of suicides that has been growing and is almost an epidemic amongst the wounded warrior population when they don't stay engaged and they're not productive again. Some of the things we do in the mental health realm, we have a number of programs. I'm going to briefly run through them. One is called Project Odyssey. It's an outward bound style program. We take warriors who have hit a snag in their mental health recovery. We bring them out to an event with counselors from the VA, and they do team building, ropes courses, things like that, and then a lot of healing rituals, and we use that to jumpstart their rehab. We've also started an online combat stress program to reach warriors in rural areas where they're isolated, teaching them cognitive behavioral therapy techniques. We do that in partnership with the Boston VA and Boston University, and we're seeing great results from that so far. In terms of physical healing, we run adaptive sports events all over the country. Last year, we served 500 warriors through those programs. It's 20 different types of sporting events. We take warriors right out of the hospital first time, get them re-engaged, get them physical, show them what they can still do after an injury. We also have an incredible amount of support that we do for family caregivers. You know, some of the most severely wounded warriors, their families are giving up their jobs. Their families are giving up their own lives, mothers, sisters, brothers, to take care of those warriors, and we provide them with retreats, we provide them with support and respite, and on our policy and advocacy level, we just created a comprehensive program in the government to provide them with a modest stipend, health care of their own, mental health services. Finally, economic empowerment. We've got the only education center in the country that takes at-risk wounded warriors, those who've had a failed job attempt
or a failed attempt at returning to work. We bring them down to Jacksonville for a year. We're opening another center in San Antonio, and we provide them with tutoring, goal setting, combat stress support, physical activity, and really re-engage them and get them back. And so far, we have an 85% success rate in getting those warriors who have had a failed past attempt to get back in society. They're being successful now. So with that, I think I'm about at the end of my time. So I will yield it back to you.
Yes, they have.
Please join us on stage for us before.
Do you want me to go?
Yeah, you can. Wow.
What's that?
Well, thank you, Ken Fisher and Marty Edelman, for coming.
Sorry, we're late.
All right. We reshuffled corners.
Steve saved me a little time setting context, so he gave me like 2 minutes back because I was going to start out with the same thing that he did. I will reframe the context a little bit. Steve talked a lot about some of the significant physical injuries. I'm going to expand that context a little bit and try to put it in simple terms. About 2.4 million men and women have deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan since 2001. And conservatively, experts suggest that about 30% of those individuals will transition from military life to civilian life with an enduring physical or psychological disability. And again, that is a rate unprecedented in U.S. history. If you do some quick math, that's a very big population. My program is probably a little different than anything else you're going to hear about today. I'm an entrepreneurship professor. I'm also a military veteran. I served 14 years in the Air Force and got out back in 2006. And found myself an entrepreneurship professor at one of the top entrepreneurship programs in the country, and I had a dean who is also a military veteran, served in the Army in Vietnam, and we got talking about what we could do to make a difference, and it occurred to us that one of the things we can do is leverage something we already do well, in this case at Syracuse University, which was teach and train entrepreneurs. So in 2007, we launched a program called the Entrepreneurship Bootcamp for Veterans with Disabilities. Put very simply, the aim of this program is to leverage the power and flexibility inherent in self-employment and business ownership to allow our veterans with disabilities to craft a vocational path forward for themselves and for their families. In my 9 minutes, I'm not going to have the time to explain to you in depth how this program works, but put very simply, it's an education, training, and mentorship program focused on allowing our veterans to, again, leverage entrepreneurship as a path forward for themselves. The program happens over 4 phases of training. It starts with a distance learning course, an online course, and immediately following the conclusion of that course, the veterans actually travel to the university for a 9-day immersion program in entrepreneurship. Coming along to the university with those veterans are some of the most accomplished entrepreneurs, entrepreneurship academics, CEOs of Fortune 500 companies that come and teach and mentor the veterans while they're at the university going through this residency. When I say accomplished, some of our professors include, for example, the CEO of Walmart teaches in our program, the founder of iRobot, 20 of the folks listed last year on the top 100 up-and-coming entrepreneurs teach in our program. And then the third phase of the program is to plug the veterans into a very robust mentorship and support model for the next year, where we leverage the resources of the university, leverage the resources of our alumni, and a network of national partners to help these veterans launch and grow a sustainable small business. And some of those small businesses are now turning into large businesses. Importantly, this program is a social venture. It is a not-for-profit that is situated in a higher education context. Everything that we do for these veterans is done entirely for free, so there is no cost to the veteran to go through this entire program. And again, it's funded privately. It is not a government program. We leverage the resources of the university to be able to do this in a way that makes economic sense. I could talk forever about how the program works, but what I've decided to do instead is show you a short little CNN story that features one of our veterans and does a good job telling the story of our program.
like somebody hit me in the face with a 2x4.
It was an IED explosion in Iraq that nearly killed Brian Iglesias. In total, nearly 40,000 American men and women have been injured fighting in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Brian's story has been phenomenal.
Mike Haney and Brian Iglesias were brought together by war, both veterans and now both entrepreneurs.
What is entrepreneurship? What are the fundamentals of entrepreneurship?
After serving 14 years in the Air Force, Haney became a professor of entrepreneurship. But he saw his fellow veterans struggling to find work after returning from war.
Self-employment, entrepreneurship, going out and starting a business has been a vocational path that the government has virtually ignored when it comes to the transition process for veterans.
So what was it like for you looking for work after serving for so long?
It was probably one of the toughest things I had to go through, because then when you don't get a job, you know, it's like rejection after rejection after rejection after rejection. It gets pretty tough.
So Haney set out to change that, founding the Entrepreneurship Bootcamp for Veterans with Disabilities, or EBV. It's a free training program for vets who want to start their own businesses. The competition is steep, but vets that make the cut take 40 days of online classes and then a summer course at one of six universities that have signed on.
The most American dream possible, I think, business ownership. That's the aim of this program. Passion is the number one criteria.
Brian's passion was film, and he set out to make movies, starting his own production company.
It was that purpose. It was that mission. It was, we will do it no matter how tired you are, no matter how hungry you are. You don't have an option to quit or stop. I don't want to owe anybody any money. Right? So I found another veteran, got together, said, well, let's do it.
Brian had no resources. He bootstrapped. You know, that's what we call it in entrepreneurship. He bootstrapped, found a way to get his movie made.
The result was a documentary about the brutal Korean War battle at Chosin, and it's now being turned into a $100 million feature film, and Brian will be an executive producer.
So what the military, what we're really, really good at is managing chaos, and we thrive in chaos. So in small business, that's what it's all about. As hard and as difficult as it was, it'll never, ever be as hard and as difficult as combat. Like, that's the beauty of perspective.
Is there enough help out there, Mike, right now for veterans?
I'm always going to say the answer to that question is no. We already do this thing, in this case, teach entrepreneurship. We already do it very well. Why can't we leverage something we already do very well to make a difference in the life of a veteran?
The program is mainly funded by private donors, but Pepsi just signed on as the first corporate sponsor. So far, 100 businesses have been started by EBV graduates. In New York, Poppy Harlow reporting.
As I talked about this program, I talked about it as a program that was run by Syracuse University. However, in 2008, we expanded this program to a national network of business schools all over the United States. The EBV program is now offered on the campus of six U.S. universities, and our goal is to expand it to at least 10 universities within the next 3 years. It continues to be offered without any cost to our veterans and continues to be funded privately. Again, the time card's going up in the back, so I'm going to blow through some stuff real quick. We are a very niche program. We do one thing. However, we do that one thing very well. To date, since 2007, we've put 300 Wounded Warriors through our program. From that group, so far, more than 120 businesses have been created. We have a bunch of national best practice designations, et cetera. And again, I talked about we hope to expand. We also have begun that expansion with a new program we call EBV Families, which is basically the EBV model, but will be delivered to the caregivers and spouses of severely wounded soldiers. I'm going to finish with one last thing in my 1 minute. I want to tell you the story of one of these kids, John Raftery. John was a recon Marine, multiple combat tours in Iraq, and he came back pretty beat up physically, but more than that, psychologically. His wife would tell me that this big Marine would just break into tears unexpectedly. She would go to work in the morning and find him sitting in a dark room by himself, and she'd come home from work in the evening, and he's sitting in the same chair. John came to the EBV program in 2007 with a vague idea about starting some sort of construction company. Today, John's construction company, Patriot Construction, has 7 employees, all disabled veterans themselves. He'll do $3 million in revenue in 2010. But the point I want to make about John is John says his business healed him. The empowerment that comes with entrepreneurship, according to John, healed him from the perspective of it gave him back the sense of autonomy and control and purpose that he lost in Iraq. So in closing, that's what the EBV program is about, trying to leverage the American dream and cultivate the next great generation of veteran entrepreneurs. Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Ken Fisher. I'm the chairman of the Fisher House Foundation. Fisher House is a 501c3 public-private partnership whose mission statement is very simple. It's to improve the quality of life for our military servicemen, women, veterans, and most importantly, their families. We do this by honoring the sacrifices made by their families on a daily basis, the depth of which the average American really has no concept of. So what Fisher House does is we build comfort homes of various sizes at the various medical treatment facilities, both for DOD, Department of Defense, and Veterans Affairs around the nation. We work very closely with the Surgeons General and with the Secretary of Veterans Affairs, who tell us where the needs are the greatest, and that's where we go and build the house. So if we're getting donations that come in, we don't just build the houses in locations that sound great. We actually build them where they are needed the most. The origins of the program were back in 1990. It was founded by my late uncle, Zachary Fisher. Zach had already converted the Intrepid aircraft carrier into an air, sea, and space museum in New York City and still wanted to do more, and was told a story about a sailor sleeping in his car at Bethesda Naval Hospital. And the wife of then Chief of Naval Operations, Pauline Trost, walked over to the car and knocked on the window and asked the sailor what he was doing. And the sailor said, well, my wife is in the hospital and I can't afford a hotel room. And that is how the program was born. These men and women make sacrifices on a daily basis. And those who have worn the uniform may have made sacrifices and continue in some cases to do so. And this country owes them a debt of gratitude that I don't think anybody can ever hope to repay. But Fisher House is one step towards repaying that service, that dedication to duty, that selfless service that keeps us free. So Fisher Houses are built within walking distance to the hospitals. So when a family comes to the hospital after a loved one has been wounded or is sick, and they're thrown together with basically two things in common. One, they can't afford a hotel room. And two, they've got a loved one who's been sick or wounded, and it's got to be the most stressful time that anyone can imagine. So Fisher House will now house them for as long as the hospital stay dictates. In some cases, the average stay was about 2 weeks. But due to the depth of the injuries that they're sustaining right now in Iraq and Afghanistan, the average stay is now almost 60 days. But in some cases, it can go months, even over a year. So Fisher Houses act as a shelter for no cost for these families to stay in. What happens inside the houses are really something very special, which we weren't aware would ever happen. Because when you throw a group of families together, you don't know how they're going to operate. This is not a hotel. The houses are basically designed to encourage interaction of the families so that a support system forms. So if a family comes in and is having a bad day, chances are there's a family that's already been through that. And they coach each other and they help each other through it. When one family has a good day, they share the joy of that day. So having the families together, coaching and kind of helping each other through this very stressful time, I think is a benefit that can't be measured. To date, we've built 49 of these houses around the country. The 50th house is going to open November 10th, and that's how we deviate from our core mission. Fisher House is always focused on the healing process, but we were made aware of a situation at Dover, which is the mortuary for the military. And unfortunately, this is a harsh reality of what we're doing. Not every story ends well. We were made aware that families, when they come in to repatriate the remains, had to, they do it very, very early in the morning, about 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning. And then after that, would get into a car and drive 7 or 8 miles to a hotel. So Fisher House, our 50th house actually, is going to be at Dover Air Force Base to accommodate those families. And along with it is going to be a kind of a non-denominational chapel or spiritual center where they can go and meditate if that's what they need to do. So there'll be 50 November 10th, and then 8 more will follow. This current capital program has been valued at about $80 million. We do get help from the government, but it's less than 5% of our capital program. What we do, what we've been able to accomplish, we've been able to accomplish through the generosity of the American people. To date, the foundation's results have been pretty impressive. In 20 years of the program, we have saved 130,000 families over $150 million in travel and lodging expenses. Fisher House has also kind of deviated a little bit from the core mission by starting a program called Hero Miles, which is a program that's a partnership with the airlines where people can donate their unused frequent flyer miles to us, and we in turn will buy tickets for family members that are not covered by travel orders, such as fiancés or aunts and uncles, anybody who's part and parcel to the healing process. The future of the program is going to be geared more towards the VA. There's been, as you may know, a 95% battlefield survivor rate. So these men and women are living with wounds that would have been fatal in previous conflicts. However, they're going to be living with these injuries that are going to require extensive rehabilitation, and that's going to be done through the VA. So these are young men and women in their 20s that are going to need this system potentially for 40 or 50 years. So of the list that we've gotten for the future, which has been valued by present value dollars at about 65 to 70 million, 90% of those houses will be earmarked for the VA. We run it like a business. And I used to say we run it like a public company, but now I say that we run it like a public company that didn't need a bailout. 97 cents on every dollar goes to the capital program. There's no waste in this foundation. There's transparency, even though 501c3s, as we all know, are unregulated. There is no Sarbanes-Oxley for our world. So we've decided that we would police ourselves. We have an audit committee that no family member can sit on. That's how we maintain independence. In addition, we have an executive committee that meets regularly. But it's important to note that the audit committee meets without the chairman being there. So there is layers of transparency here because this is not my day job. This is a job that I do because A, it's a privilege to do it. But B, this is my way of serving this nation. I never wore the uniform. So if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. So again, I know I'm running out of time. It's very difficult to tell this story in 9 minutes. I just pray to the good Lord that I've hit the major points. So anyway, thank you very much.
Yeah, I could use some. Good afternoon. My name is Marty Edelman, and I apologize. I've been negotiating all night with Kenny on something that it's got my voice. I think, you know, before I start about the Fallen Heroes Fund, I think what you're hearing today deserves an overall comment because it reflects one of the failures of our society. Private groups have had to come in and fill the gaps that people, I think, assumed the government filled in helping service personnel. We have a volunteer military. So our sons and daughters aren't getting drafted like I was in Vietnam and probably many of you. And so when these kids volunteer, it seems to me the society makes an implied covenant with them that when they come back, if they don't come back whole, it is our responsibility to take care of them and to help them reestablish themselves in the world they choose to go in. And we have, I think, as a society, failed in certain critical areas. And what you're hearing from the people here today is the identification of those areas, the way we are trying to fill them, and the importance of the support that we get from the community at large as well as the government. The Fallen Heroes Fund was started in 2003 to fill a gap that we identified when we found out that those who were killed in Afghanistan and Iraq, their families got $6,000 and had to leave the military base within 60 days with only partial health insurance. We thought that was a travesty. So we formed the Fallen Heroes Fund, and the directors of the Fallen Heroes Fund pay for its operations so that all the gifts go to the projects. We're totally a task-based organization. We don't have a program in the sense that you've heard from the other gentlemen here today. What we do is we identify a task, pursue it to its conclusion, and then move to a new task. So in 2003, we raised $20 million and gave every family $11,000, every child $5,000, and every unmarried service member's family $1,000, so it would ease the transition for those families from being part of the military system to back to civilian life. We, together with many others, lobbied the Congress of the United States, and after 2.5 years, not 2.5 minutes, they changed the law, and service members' families are adequately provided for now in the case of death. We then asked the government what the next challenge would be, and it was determined that the medical facilities for those who had lost arms and legs was really inadequate. There were facilities, but they really didn't have the state-of-the-art kind of medical equipment and technologists. So we raised $60 million and built the Center for the Intrepid, which we donated to the government in Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, Texas, completely equipped with the most modern prosthetic balance devices. We actually traveled all over the world and got the best experts to determine how we could best help these young men and women be rehabilitated. That's been in operation for 2.5 years very successfully. We finished that task and we asked the government what's next. The government wasn't sure, but we read the newspaper and we were sure. And that is the invisible wound of Afghanistan and Iraq is traumatic brain injury. It is pervasive. For any of us who have been in Vietnam, we see a lot of the homeless veterans that we see who live under bridges basically have traumatic brain injury, undiagnosed, uncared for. And so we decided that we would do something about that. So Ken's uncle, Ken's dad, actually, Arnold Fisher, and I went and took the traumatic brain injury course at UCLA, got a better understanding of what was needed. The Fallen Heroes Fund raised $65 million. We built the Traumatic Brain Injury Center, which we dedicated on June 24th on the grounds of the Bethesda Naval Hospital. And because of the uncertainty connected with the treatment of traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress syndrome, we decided to create a research fund. And so our fundraising now is focused on completing the fundraising for the research fund. We have about $8 million that's available for it. And this will allow the collection of data with respect to traumatic brain injury together with the development of unique treatment protocols. So as these young men and women who we treat in the Traumatic Brain Injury Center re-enter society or go back to the military, and just one aside is an extraordinary number of the reservists who come in work either part-time or full-time as first responders in local communities throughout the United States. They come back, and if they're not capable of functioning at a highly normal level, those communities are really deprived of their service and their community commitments. And so what we've done in building this center is we have equipped it with the latest brain imaging equipment, as well as helping them develop a coterie of extraordinarily talented psychiatrists and psychologists who will take 20 service members at a time and treat them, develop treatment protocols, and then not only allow them to go back either to their base or into society, but to also be able to what we call have a string on them. So we have a way of evaluating what they're facing and trying to provide continued aftercare so that we can monitor it. When someone loses an arm or a leg and you fit a prosthetic device, they know whether they're functioning or not. You see stories every day now about what happens to people who suffer from traumatic brain injury. And so even though this is, you know, intended to be sort of an upscale presentation by us, because we all believe passionately in what we're doing, I want to leave you with a story that didn't turn out well as a way of sort of highlighting how important it is that we as a society recognize the impact of traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress syndrome. This is the story of Baldemar Gonzalez, 39 years old, combat paratrooper veteran, who served in both Iraq and Afghanistan and was part of a roadside incendiary device explosion, came back with traumatic brain injury, suffered nightmares, insomnia, and some of the other kinds of things, forgetfulness, couldn't identify his children from time to time, was treated on a base in good faith, a lot of medication, created a certain amount of haziness in his life, and on September 25th of this year, he went upstairs and he shot himself. And that is happening in a way that's unprecedented for our military. And so if you look at the spectrum of what the four of these organizations do, what you'll see is some of us focusing on sort of the early root causes of the problems these veterans face, some focused on making the families be able to be part of the rehabilitation, as Fisher House does, and some of them take the soldier wounded, partially wounded, and help them reenter society in a way that makes it better for them, makes it better for us, and allows us to fulfill the implied covenant we have when they signed up. Thank you.
Well, thank you again, all of you, for what you've done. It's really inspiring work. I know at the roundtable and as an audience member and other panels, one of the things we're always very interested in is metrics and how you measure your impact. Each of you have talked about different statistics that indicate that. I wonder if you could elaborate a little on some of the challenges of measuring impact when it's grayer areas. Think that would be of interest, some of the most important statistics you have, and also how easy is it to get funding to also support that kind of metrics that you need?
I can start. If it wasn't for this public-private partnership that we have, it would be very difficult, because then we'd have to go back and raise money. Once we build our houses, we gift them to whichever branch of the military they serve, and they staff and maintain them. The biggest problem that we have from time to time is this ingrained bureaucracy, this bureaucratic culture that is within the military and within the VA. And it can be very, very difficult at times for the foundation to kind of circumvent through that. I can give you an example. When it came to our site work, the VA and the DOD would normally help to clear the land and put the infrastructure in. And certain, you know, it varied from place to place, but sometimes it would happen a little bit slower. And in some cases, that actually cost us a donation because it wasn't happening fast enough. So I think the biggest challenge is to kind of point out that this bureaucracy is why things are slowing down, why our men and women and veterans aren't getting the care in the way that they need to.
See, we learned the lesson from Kent. So our arrangements with the government are they gift the land to the Fallen Heroes Fund. We build it. We pay for everything. We build it. We take no money from the government, so we're not restricted by them. We built Traumatic Brain Injury Center, which is a 72,000 square foot facility in 15 months. And so we really avoid the bureaucracy that way. Metrics are hard in the sense that the Center for the Intrepid has treated, I think, 2,300 victims or amputees since it's opened and is full constantly. It's also connected to the burn center, and so a number of the burn victims, which really suffer unbelievably, also use the center. The government, you know, we turn it back to them. We turn it back to them fully equipped, fully staffed, and then they pay for operations. We found that when you focus on a thing, on a structure, and you give it to the government, and you negotiate how they're going to run it, they actually run it. They run it the way our agreement says they're going to run it. I think if we didn't have this agreement, it wouldn't run as well. Traumatic brain injury, I don't know how we're going to measure that.
If I could jump in on metrics, because I have an idea about this. We have, in the organization, I've got 16 different programs, and they all focus on different areas. You know, I talked to you about that, mental health, physical health. We've got 48 key performance indicators across programs. They're measurements from everything from did somebody get a skill if it's an education program? You know, did they learn a skill in terms of adaptive sports? Are they still active in terms of their physical activity if that's the goal of the program? One of the challenges we as charities often face is that there's a push-pull between do I want to run another person through my program and help them because I believe that I can help another person, or do I take some of that money and put it into a measurement process to know how effective I am? And I think we need to do both, and I think one of the things that we've been successful at with some funders, and this is probably something you guys can be can drive in the charity industry, is taking a portion of your funds and setting it aside for metrics. So when we've worked, I'll give you an example, on our TTA program, I didn't talk about it earlier, we train warriors to get skills in the IT field where they can get up to an A++ certification, go get a job in the IT field. We partnered with Cisco on that, got some funding from that foundation, and they worked with us to say, that's great, you're going to run a bunch of people through the program, but we're going to work with you on what would be an effective outcome. How many of those graduates should come out successfully? How many of them should get a job? What should their salary be? And working that into your funding can guarantee that you did two things. You know that you're getting the value out of your dollar in terms of making the impact you want, but the charity then learns how to do that, and particularly for small charities, it's hard for them to set aside the money, and then they've developed a way to measure their own success and improve their programs over time.
I guess the only thing I'll add to that is one of the other challenges is figuring out what to measure. And it's one of the things that has really been driven home to me now over 5 years of running my program. When I talk to potential donors or donors, I run an entrepreneurship training program. And the first question, you can guess, how many businesses have they started? You know, how many people do they employ? It sort of goes down that road. But helping them, one of the outcomes of our program that was unintended, but I count as a great outcome, is we have a very high percentage of folks that come through our program with no college education that after going through our program choose to go back to school, that tell us on our intake form, hey, I have no desire to, pursue a college degree, et cetera. But yet those same folks, after they end up in a classroom at UCLA or Florida State or Texas A&M, say, hey, maybe I really can do this college thing. And they end up going back to school. Well, that's hard. That's a great outcome. I count that as a win, but that's difficult sometimes to explain the importance of both measuring and figuring out what those second-order outcomes are and then communicating them to your community of stakeholders and in a way that they also accept them as positive outcomes of what you're trying to do.
So change in attitudes, too, is a big thing, and how do you measure that? Another question, I know from my work in education, there's a lot of talk lately about how technology and online access and social media can help revolutionize education. I'm wondering if you have thoughts on how those same items can either impact your programs or how you leverage them or would like to leverage them to spread the impact of your programs.
Well, I think the internet and the kind of programs that are set up to measure the foundations are invaluable. This is something that we've never had before. If somebody wants to check out a foundation before they actually give to it, there's a variety of tools that they can use to go on and check out that foundation and see how well they're spending their money and see if there is an impact and so forth. There's Charity Navigator and things of that nature. So I think it's had a positive impact in that it's given people more awareness of how their dollar is going, that they're not just donating to a name, that there is an actual method to the madness of the foundation, the mission.
I mean, I'll talk about it from the perspective of the veterans in an education context. I'm learning how to tweet, and I didn't even really understand what that was at some point, but I'm using those tools because as I said in my talk, our goal is to build a community of veteran entrepreneurs, and we deliver our program at 6 universities. Veterans go through in cohorts of 25 at a time, but I want all of them connected nationally. I want them talking to each other. I want them buying from each other. And we use social media and technology as a way to create a network amongst our graduates. So whether they went through the program at UCLA or Texas A&M or Purdue, they are all graduates of the program, and technology really allowed us to do that.
And if I can just, I'll just add quickly, I agree with Mike on this. Certainly these are 20-somethings, that's the age group, they are living online. I have a Facebook page, never thought I'd have one. I had to do that to stay engaged with the constituents. What we found is it's great for social networking, it's great for engagement, and you can leverage it to reach a broad, technology and social media and the internet to reach a broader population. And that works in some areas like the program we're doing in combat stress. We found in others, like a learning environment, that blended learning works better. So we deliver some of our courses online. When we've tried to do it solely online, our experience has been that the drop-off rates spike incredibly. And having an in-classroom setting and having some support systems and some hand-holding along with that online program has been most effective for us.
The field of telemedicine is where the technology applies to some of the things we're doing. One of the projects we're looking at next is we were somewhat surprised that they're not using telemedicine effectively in the treatment of traumatic brain injury and post-traumatic stress syndrome, which would allow centers that have really talented psychiatrists and psychologists to actually treat wounded soldiers all over the globe using telemedicine. They don't use it as effectively in the trauma hospitals and the battlefield either. They have some of it. So we're thinking of trying to figure out a way to develop a fund that would support the programs that the government has and expand them and bring in the talent they need. The bureaucracy is, I think we've all felt it. We felt it because it took us 2.5 years to get the approval to build the Traumatic Brain Injury Center when TBI had become the watchword of the invisible wound of the war. And it still took us 2.5 years to get the Department of Defense to accept what we were going to do. And it wasn't malevolence. It just nobody was willing to take responsibility for it.
Yeah. I hear there might be a prize for a mobile device that helps diagnose. I'll tell you. I have a question. Okay. I'm going to ask one more question. The role of philanthropy, you've talked about it in different ways in helping you get started. Could you talk a little bit more about the roles philanthropy has played in starting your programs and sustaining them, and perhaps also things that you'd caution against that are not helpful that philanthropy has done or could do that you've seen?
Well, in my case, it has been a generational thing. Philanthropy is, I would like to think, is a gene that the family has. It's just something that has been passed down and will continue to be passed down. Which it's an obligation to give back. And in our case, it was finding, that niche, that finding the need that these families who had given so much and bear so much burdens needed this foundation so badly, because that too often we sit back and wonder, why isn't this being done and why isn't that being done? Rather than just saying it's not. And I can make a difference. I have the means to do it. And I think it's something that's, it's more than just something that's in your heart. It needs to be something that's not just money. I think it's a full body experience in my mind. Philanthropy is something that not only helps other people, but I think helps you. Mm-hmm. I think in the long run.
600,000 Americans gave us money for the Center for the Intrepid. I think the only pernicious element of philanthropy in this country, and this is very personal, no, don't be offended, is the whole business about naming. We had a Fortune 500 company come to us and say, we'll give you $10 million in the traumatic brain injury funds we were raising if you'll name the center, you know, for our company. And we decided that the little kids who were doing the lemonade stand and actually sent us $3.80 were really as important for our troops to understand how widespread the support was, that we actually were arrogant enough to reject it. And we had ended up raising the money. We raised $42 million, and we had a gentleman give a $20 million anonymous gift because he understood the sort of philosophy that we have. So I think this whole naming thing can sort of cause conflicts in the way you go about doing it. If you want to use your name, that's fine. I just our experience.
Good for you. The importance of philanthropy. Well, my organization, like a lot of the ones here, we don't take government funds for a lot of the same reasons that these guys don't. I think the government's very good at a safety net for veterans. I think sometimes there's a misperception that the government does everything. They do some things very well. They do health care, particularly physical health care, very well. But if your goal is to heal an individual and empower them to future success, particularly someone who served their country and put their country, their life on the line for us, then that's the job of the whole community. And it really speaks volumes to an individual service member returning home to know that there's a community of support, to know that individuals are giving money into organizations who are here to help them heal. And I think that it's vitally important, not just so we can provide the services, but because of the message that sends our men and women while they're serving. In terms of good and bad in philanthropy, I see a lot of good. Probably the one challenge that I've seen is a lot of things happen over and over again because people give money towards a program or an idea that's been tried. And unfortunately, some of this is on us, some of this is on funders. We don't always share our information as well as we should. And so then you have people trying something. I'd rather learn the lessons that Mike's learned and have Mike learn mine than us repeat each other's mistakes. And I think as a charity group, we do better at that. This group here, I've worked with all three of these organizations in the past. I've worked with Warriors and gone to them. But I think as a whole, we could be doing a better job of that.
Mm-hmm. Don't you hate that word competition?
Yeah.
Because we don't
horrendous.
Compete.
Yeah. I don't know if you want to learn my lessons. I feel out of place up here. And this question really drives it home. And the reason I guess I feel out of place is, some of the numbers that I've heard are not numbers that I've ever heard in my program. I'm the startup, and it costs X amount of money to put one veteran through my program, and that's a big deal for me. And if I can get that, and I really think it would be a real it would be a very difficult decision for me. At the stage, because I know what I can do. I know that how my program can grow, and I know that there's more applications than I have capacity for. And if I were presented with a situation like you are presented with, I think I'm in a different position. And that would be very, very difficult for me.
Yeah,
and I'm not sure
okay.
how I'd.
It would be okay because the purpose is what matters. Right?
Yeah, yeah. So it is a challenge. I mean, I will say this. That my program never would have got off the ground if it weren't for the fact that there were a few folks, in this case alumni of Syracuse University, who I had a chance to pitch to, and they said, you know what, we're going to help you make this happen, and some folks wrote checks. And mm-hmm. But, to this day, 5 years later, it is still an ongoing struggle, and it's something that
there are definitely days where I say to myself, what the heck am I doing? Yeah, because it is a challenge.
I just want to make two quick observations. One, from the battlefield to the bed, the American military is well served by the medical profession. The courage of the Army medical teams is extraordinary. And the young men and women who are injured on the battlefield get extraordinary care and extraordinary airlift and extraordinary trauma rescue. So we should never fail to mention that. Mm-hmm. The second thing is, I think Americans are incredibly generous. I think all of us have had the experience of going to strange places and trying to raise money and been actually had tears for in gratitude for what the American people do when they understand those gaps that I was talking about in terms of the way we protect our folks in the military.